Bachelor's of Science degree in rehabilitation from McGill University, where she was the recipient of the Minister of Education Gold Medal. She then obtained a master's degree from the University of Saskatchewan and returned to McGill for her PhD. She has been a highly productive scholar. She has received numerous grants from very competitive granting agencies. And for those of you who are more interested in output than input, she has also been a very productive scholar in terms of publishing in varied and distinguished journals. Perhaps even more important, she has been the supervisor and mentor of a large number of graduate students who have contributed themselves to the development of her field across Canada and internationally. She has received an honorary degree from the University of Ottawa. Currently, she is professor in the Rehabilitation Department at Laval University, director of the Rehabilitation Research Center of the Quebec Rehabilitation Institute, and she holds a Canadian research chair in rehabilitation. Her research interests are primarily in movement disorders, but when you look at her publications, it's clear that this is an interdisciplinary and widely diverse field of activity. So she's equally at home dealing with children with cerebral palsy, with young adults who may have spinal cord injuries, or with the often more elderly who may have suffered brain damage such as stroke. I could go on for some time, but let me just quote from one of the nominees whose suggestion resulted in her being here as a Cecil and Ida Green visiting professor. That nominee said, "She is an internationally acclaimed rehabilitation researcher. She will speak to us this evening in maximizing walking capacity in stroke." It's a great pleasure to welcome Dr. Richards.
Thank you very much, Dr. Weber. It is indeed a pleasure and a great honor to be here. Members of the Vancouver Institute, friends, and I have one relative, ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you about the last 15 years of my research. It's on. Maybe put it higher. Okay. Is that better? I have entitled the talk Maximizing Walking Capacity After Stroke, and as I just mentioned, I will summarize about the last 15 years of my research, and as I go along, I will tell you which of my colleagues contributed to this work, because as you know, it's not possible to do research alone as an island, and we are always dependent on our colleagues. So I will start off with a bit of a definition. What is a stroke? And you can read along if you like. A stroke is a sudden loss of brain function. It is caused by the interruption of the flow of blood to the brain. You can have either an ischemic stroke when that happens, or if there's a rupture of blood vessels, you would have a hemorrhagic stroke. And what I've shown up here is a brain that has had an ischemic stroke, which is about 80% of strokes. And what you see in here are the cells that have died, and around the side here, this dark line, is a penumbra. Those are cells in that area that are ischemic, but are still viable. And so that is caused by the interrupted flow or the rupture of the blood vessels in the affected area, which cause these neurons to die. The effects of a stroke then depend upon where the brain was injured, as well as how much damage occurred. Let me just give you a few statistics about stroke in Canada to set the picture. Each year, approximately 50,000 Canadians suffer a brain attack that will lead to death or serious disability. About 300,000 Canadians are presently living with the effects of stroke. Many stroke survivors face physical and mental challenges that greatly affect their quality of life and, of course, that of their families. Stroke also has a major economic impact. The cost, when we look at both direct and indirect costs, of this disease is estimated to be about $4 billion a year in Canada. Now, what are the consequences of stroke on walking? Since the brain controls everything we say and everything we do and everything we think, a stroke can have a wide variety of effects. This lecture concerns the ability to walk. Up to 80% of persons with stroke initially lose their ability to walk independently. Up to 33% may require assistance or supervision to walk 3 months after their stroke. Most walk slowly and lack walking competency even years after their stroke. Now, what is walking competency? We define walking competency as a level of walking ability that allows an individual to successfully navigate in their community. And to do this, the criteria include being able to walk at speeds, allowing them to safely cross streets. And if you like figures, 77 to 138 centimeters per second. Now, what does that mean? A person who is elderly, somewhere between, they tell me elderly starts at 49, but somewhere between 49 and 60, will walk at about 130 to 150 centimeters per second. Now, if you want to cross a street in a big city like Vancouver, you have to walk at about 120 centimeters per second to get across before the light changes. The capacity to walk long enough distances is also very important in order to allow you to accomplish tasks of daily living. And the figure that we quote is about 300 meters. You also have to be able to negotiate raised curbs. You also have to be able to have enough balance that when you go shopping and somebody bumps into you, you don't fall down. You also have to demonstrate anticipatory strategies to avoid or to accommodate to obstacles. So these are my objectives for this evening. To review the results of clinical studies carried out over the last 15 years that relate to the recovery of walking after stroke. I will show you how stroke recovers over time. I will give you some data on studies evaluating a new task-oriented physical therapy approach in persons with acute stroke. And I will review the results of studies designed to improve walking capacity in persons with chronic stroke. Now, what is acute and what's chronic? We need a definition. So acute is from 0 to 3 months. After that, from 3 months to 6 months, it's in the middle, and after 6 months, it's chronic. And finally, I will briefly describe ongoing and future studies. Now, this is a curve that gives you a classical curve that you would find in the literature, and it tells you the rate of recovery after a stroke as measured by clinical measures. And those are measures that professionals will use where they look at how you move or they measure how you manage tasks, and they rate it on a scale, various scales. In this case, I've given you all scales on one axis, so it's 0 to 100%. What you see B here means baseline, onset of stroke. And in this case, it's in 1 week after stroke. And so what you see here is there's a rapid recovery from baseline to 6 weeks, and then a little bit more from 6 weeks to 3 months, and then there's a plateau. And somewhere here, you start to have what we call chronic stroke. Now, there's a problem with these measures, is that, you see, once they get close to 100%, they plateau off. We call that a ceiling effect. It means that the measure that is taken to define what is happening is not sensitive enough to small changes. Now, let me show you what would happen if we use some other measures. Now, this slide gives you, in this part, and this part, the same information I gave you on the previous slide. It's just presented in another way to show you the statistics. And let's just take this one here, which is the Berg Recovery Scale, which is a scale for balance. And what it shows you here is that there's a change from 6 weeks to 3 months, and then nothing more. If I go to this one here, which is a measure of impairment, in other words, how you are capable of dissociating movements, how you can, when a therapist asks you to make a movement, how you make that movement and how they rate it. And what you see here is baseline, Here you see baseline, rapid recovery, and then next to nothing. But if you measure something like gait speed, where you can have an objective measure, here you have it here, and you see 6 weeks all the way to 12 to 18 months continues to improve. And I could show you other objective measures that also continue to show improvement. So we have to be careful when we define improvement. It does not necessarily stop at 6 months. It's just that we haven't been able to measure it. So I'll tell you about how we went about trying to improve therapy for persons with acute stroke. Now, you have to put yourself back in the context of 1988, and at the time, task-oriented physical therapy was not at all usual. We knew then, from about 8 or 9 years of animal work and some preliminary work in patients, that if we asked patients to perform tasks that were related to the problem, that, in other words, if people can't walk, then you have to make them walk in the therapy situation. And so at the time, the therapy was relatively passive and was not at all task-oriented. So this pilot study was one of the first studies that attempted to examine the effects of a task-oriented therapy in patients with acute stroke. And I give you just one picture here of a person walking on a treadmill with a support system. Support system was just there to catch them should they fall. And so this was the, So this was the plan. This was a pilot study, therefore we don't have a great number of patients. But we had three groups with three different physical therapy regimens, treated over a 5-week period in an acute hospital setting. Now, when we submitted the grant, we were interested in comparing task-oriented therapy to conventional therapy. But the granting agency asked us to include a third group and gave us the money to do it. And that was early, late. Because in our hospital at the time, it turned out that the physical therapy department was a long way away from the neurology department. And the patients didn't go down to physical therapy until they could sit for an hour in a wheelchair. So often they didn't start physical therapy until 3 or 4 weeks after stroke. And to make a long story short, once we started this program, there was what we called contamination, and suddenly patients were treated earlier. And so I wasn't able to answer that question. So I won't talk about it anymore. And so what we did is we said, not only do we want to do task-oriented physical therapy, but from the literature, we know that it should be early. And so this is one of the very first studies where we controlled for the lesion. It was all middle cerebral artery infarcts, confirmed by CAT scan, and we were able to see them in the first week after stroke. And therapy started around day 8 after stroke. So that was the early group. And what we did is we said it's got to be intense. And so we doubled the therapy time, 2 hours a day instead of the usual 1 hour a day. And we practiced an experimental therapy that I will briefly describe to you. That had been previously described by Dr. Mauwai in a prior paper. Now, we compared this new therapy to another early group, equal intensity, but with the same conventional therapy. And the third group was late, about 3 weeks post-stroke. The usual therapy, which happened to be less than 1 hour, and the type of therapy was conventional therapy. Now let me show you what we did in this group. The activities that we included that were not usually included were tilt table, in other words, we had the patient up as soon as possible, Kinetron, which is sort of a bicycle that you do in either sitting or standing with alternate movements, and these movements are resisted, treadmill, and conventional gait, which we would have done anyway. And so what this graph shows you are the weeks of therapy, week 1 to 5, and what you have here is the mean weekly time, the mean weekly time that the patients on average needed the tilt table, and the number up here are the number of patients that needed it that first week. And what this shows you is that we had some 3 patients who needed it the first week, and then they didn't need it anymore. And here you have use of the Kinetron, the mean weekly time, the number of patients that needed it, and the same thing here. And this is for the treadmill. 4 people were able to go on the treadmill the first week. The second week, it was 6, and then all 9 patients in the experimental group. And over here is the time spent on usual walking tasks. So this was quite different from usual therapy at that time. Now this slide gives you the maximal treadmill velocity attained by each of the patients in that group. This is the experimental group. And you have here the speed in meters per second. And what you have here is how long each of those patients trained during that 5-week period. And you can see for yourself, this trend follows this trend. And what that tells us is there's a relationship between the speed that the patient attained and the time they spent training. And if you like statistics, it's a rho statistic of 0.9. Now this gives you the comparison of the total physical therapy treatment time that each group had. Now this had never been measured before. This was done by Dr. Mauwai, one of my co-authors, with the therapist, and they measured what the therapist did each 5 minutes. And so for the experimental group, this is the mean duration of the total therapy over the 5 weeks, and what you see is that over 5 weeks, they were treated for about 40 hours. And of those 40 hours, 10 hours were dedicated to gait-related activities. The experimental group, the early conventional group, a little bit less, and a little bit less in terms of walking experience. And this is the usual. Look at the difference in therapy time. But surprisingly, the therapist had them walk as much as the group in the early conventional. Now these are the statistics that compare the primary outcome measure, which we decided would be walking velocity. And what it shows you is that the group that practiced these new activities, the experimental group, walked faster than either the early conventional or the conventional. And then because there's no difference between these two, you can put them together and compare these two groups together versus the experimental group. You have an effect size, which is a statistic that we use when we have small groups. And what it tells us is that there's a very high likelihood that if we had more patients in each group, that it would be a statistical difference. Then you have to ask yourself the question, why did the patients in this experimental group walk faster? And so we looked at it this way. We put total training time along the x-axis, and walking speed or gait velocity along this axis. And then in looking at the dots here, the open circles are time dedicated to gait activities. And you see there's a very nice correlation here of 0.63. But when you relate walking speed to training time, total training time, you see you get this relationship, and it's no longer significant. And that allows us to talk about a concept called specificity of training. And what that says is that if you need to train a given activity, you should practice the activity that you need. And that if you need to walk, it doesn't mean you're going to get better if you do, for example, just postural activities. You must be specific to the task. Now, the application of this intense, because it was double the usual therapy time, task-oriented gait training program in patients with acute stroke told us several things. First of all, these acute patients could well tolerate walking on a treadmill and other task-specific exercises within the first weeks after stroke. And that was new information at the time. The patients were compliant to twice-a-day therapy sessions, and the family liked it too, because they thought they were doing something. The patients generally enjoyed the therapy, and as I've shown you, we were able to show that they could benefit from this approach. So, what did we do with these results? As researchers, we started over again, because here we had pilot data, and what that did is it allowed us to ask for money to do the full trial. And so, that's what we did. And we received the money from Health Canada. Because of criticism that we'd received in that people were questioning whether it was a task-oriented therapy or whether it was intensity. So in this trial, we kept the intensity the same as usual practice. Now, this new trial I'm going to tell you about, we carried out in rehabilitation units. And therefore, we could not have the patients as early. But they were still less than 3 months post-stroke. So I've called this trial comparison of task-oriented and conventional therapy after stroke. And I show you here my co-authors, Drs. Malouin, Wood, Dauphiny, and Bravo. And this randomized trial, in the end, had 62 patients. And we carried it out in the Quebec City region between 1995 and 1999. Now, it's extremely difficult to recruit patients for these trials, and it takes ages in a city the size of Quebec City with about a population of 1 million. So it took us 4 years to recruit these patients. And that had an impact on what type of therapy was conventional. Because we're researchers, and we do research, but we also teach. And of course, we talk about these things to our students. And that changes gradually how students and therapists treat. And you'll see how this has, I think, had a major impact on the results. So let's come back to intensity and duration. 1 hour a day, 5 days a week. And in this case, for 2 months. At the time, that was usual practice in Quebec City. And we measured with the clinical measures, the type that I've previously shown you. Measures taken by independent evaluators at baseline, that's when they started. 2 months later, 8 weeks post-therapy, and at follow-up, 3 months later. We also took some laboratory measures. Now, just to give you a feeling for what kind of physical therapy was done. This is the total treatment time. And we're comparing the experimental and the control. Now, recall that the control, we don't tell them what to do, it's as usual. The experimental, it's the type of therapy I've previously described. And so what you see here are the types of therapy that the therapist reported: passive movements, upper limb activities, other therapies such as electrical stimulations or TNS, that sort of thing, ice, balance and mobility activities, walking activities. You can see the only two groups that are different are this group here and this group here. Upper limb activities, there were more in the control group, and walking activities, there were more in the experimental group, which shouldn't be a surprise. But the other activities were very close. And if you look at these activities here, you realize that many of the activities are task-oriented. They relate to rising from a chair to walk and this sort of thing, and balancing and standing. So you could almost define them as task-oriented as well. They're very close. In terms of locomotor training activities, here you have the total time. And the experimental group, you have the locomotor activities or the walking activities, time on the treadmill, and time on the kinetron. And this, you have walking activities in the control group. Now, these are the results, the main results. Again, walking speed was the primary outcome measure. And what you see is that if it's measured clinically in the control group and in the experimental group, there's a remarkable doubling of walking speed. And this continues to improve 2 months later. But it's the same in the experimental group. And if you look at it as measured in the laboratory, it's the same. A little bit difference. There's a difference in the speed here because patients don't walk exactly the same speed under laboratory conditions as when they do clinically. So we were disappointed at first because we thought all this and there's no difference. So we had to explain it. And so just before I give you that explanation, I'll briefly show you some other measures just to convince you. These are the other measures we took. And you can see these are the impairment measures. Very little difference. Everything was the same. And so no matter where we looked, these here, just for an explanation here, this is the timed up and go. It's a timing test. So when you go down for this test, it's improvement. And so what you see for all these measures is there's improvement after therapy, and there's continued improvement after. So what does this tell us? We were unable to show a difference in all measures between the groups in terms of gait speed and all the secondary outcome measures. But we did see improvements in all the measures over time in both groups, remarkable changes. In fact, the gait speed more than doubled baseline values post-therapy and continued to improve in the carryover phase. And these were our conclusions. Both the task-oriented approach and the conventional approach were beneficial and produced gains that were superior to that reported in previous reports in the literature. From an analysis of the therapy content, it was apparent that both approaches were task-oriented. And we would like to think that it was an effect of our teaching, at least partially. But also, lecturers come and talk about these new approaches. And therapists go to courses. And so, in a way, I'm pleased to say that our therapists have changed the way they treat. And we don't have to impose a task-oriented approach to them. They choose to do it. And it has shown to be beneficial. Also, there's a positive side to this. This study shows, it gives evidence that expensive and sophisticated instruments, such as treadmills and kinetron isokinetic systems, are not essential to apply the task-oriented approach. And in a rich country like Canada, this may not be a problem. But in poorer countries or in isolated areas, this may be a problem. And what it says is they don't need fancy equipment to do effective physical therapy. That was a good result. So I would like, before going on to another session, to acknowledge my co-investigators, Francine Malouin, Sharon Dauphiny from McGill University, Jack Williams from University of Toronto, Gina Braville from University of Sherbrooke, my clinical collaborators, Drs. Bouchard and Brunet, and therapist Prévost and Podvin, graduate student Lamontagne, and research associates and technical assistants. And I will do it this way because I think it's very important that we acknowledge who we work with. All right, moving on to another subject. I'm now going to talk about chronic stroke. And I'm going to start by telling you about a study that is called Task-Related Circuit Training, Improves Performance of Locomotor Tasks in Chronic Stroke. And again, it's a pilot study. Now, this pilot study was done in collaboration with Catherine Dean, who was a postdoctoral student with us from Sydney, Australia. And I can attest to the fact, not only was she a marvelous therapist, but she taught us to look at stroke differently. And I'm going to give you the results from two studies that she did with us. And you'll see how dramatically different the approach is from the usual way we approach chronic stroke. So the purpose then is to investigate the feasibility and efficacy of an exercise class aimed at improving performance of locomotor-related tasks in individuals discharged from rehabilitation following stroke. So they are at home. Now, this is the design, and I've put it up, and it's a little bit detailed, but I thought it was important to explain this. One of the problems with bringing in patients from the home is that we have to control for all kinds of factors that are not related to the therapy per se. For example, it's known that just phoning patients to talk about their problems can sometimes help them, because there's a link between knowing somebody is concerned and interested and feeling good about oneself. Also, these patients often, once they're home, do not move about very much. And so here we're asking them to get into a car, to come to the rehab center, to walk to where they have to do the exercise, to do the exercise, and then to go home again. Just that is a therapy. And so we had to control for that, and this is how we did it. We had the patients come in for a pre-training evaluation, and then we randomized them into a lower limb experimental group or an upper limb experimental group. And everything was the same in both groups except the actual exercises. And so this group concentrated on locomotor-related tasks, and note, 3 times a week for 4 weeks. We're talking about 12 hours of therapy. And this group concentrated on upper extremity tasks, evaluated post-training and 2 months later. Now, the purpose of this circuit training was to improve performance and endurance by practicing functional tasks involving the lower extremities, such as walking, reaching, in sitting and standing, going up and down stairs, and rising and sitting down. We call that sit to stand. So we organize these tasks into 10 workstations in a circuit. Also added walking races or relays to encourage cooperation and competition. In all, we estimate that we had 50 minutes of practice for the workstations and 10 minutes for the races. Patients love the races. In addition, and imagine if we hadn't controlled for this, we calculated that there was about 500 meters to walk from the entrance to the practice area. This I show you not so you try to read it, but just to remind me to tell you that they were chronic stroke here, and this is time post stroke, and we controlled for the speed so that the mean speed in this group was the same, very similar to the speed in the other group, because that's what we're using as an outcome measure. So at baseline, we have comparable speed in both groups. These are the workstations. I'll just read two. The first one, reaching for objects beyond arm's length in different directions in sitting. And down here, walking on a treadmill. Just give you a moment if you want to read through it. The last one is walking over slopes and stairs. So the patients would go to one workstation, do the exercise, then go to the next, etc. They worked in a group. Now these are the results, and here I'm going to show you a comparison of the change in walking speed and endurance in the two groups. So what you have here is the difference pre-post, so it's a change score, and the open circle is the immediate effect, the square here is the retention effect, and the closed triangle is the group mean. So what you see if you compare the experimental group here to the control group here, you can readily see that there's much more positive change in the experimental group. There's very little change here. And if you look at the walking speed with no devices, the change in speed, you see the same thing. It's a little bit less than 15 centimeters per second, and it's even negative in some of the control. What I should mention here is the 6-minute walk test is the distance you can walk over 6 minutes. You're allowed to stop and rest if you need to. And we use that as a clinical measure of endurance. Now, I'm not going to go through all the different results, but I'll give you a summary. The experimental group demonstrated significant immediate and retained improvement. It was statistically significant despite the small number of patients. When compared to the control group, walking speed was faster. They had better walking endurance. And we also saw that they had better force production through the affected leg during sit to stand. And let me explain that. A person with a stroke will tend to overload the good leg when they rise from sitting. And so you can measure this difference. And improvement is then when they start to use the affected leg more. So that's what we were measuring here. And then lastly, the ability to balance and support the body mass while stepping with the unaffected leg. And this is a test where patient stands on one leg and uses the other leg to step up onto a small step. And you can do it either as a support leg or as a movement leg. So you can measure the motor capacity as well as the balancing capacity. So, where has this led us? To another trial. So we had the pilot data, and now we are participating in a multi-center trial that is recruiting subjects in Montreal, Quebec City, and Toronto to try to confirm the results of that pilot study in a larger number of subjects. The trial is led by Dr. Nancy Mayo at McGill University. And it is funded by the Canadian Heart and Stroke Foundation and the Canadian Stroke Center for Excellence. The second study done with Kathy Dean. This time, she wondered if she could evaluate patients in chronic stroke who already were good walkers, and then, from what she saw in the gait analysis, target her therapy. And so the purpose was to investigate the effect of a locomotor-related task training program with a specific component designed to increase push-off in walking on the performance of locomotor-related tasks and muscle strength in persons with chronic stroke. Now, I've used a word called push-off. So I'm going to show you a slide where I will show you how we calculate the force with which you push to propel yourself forward for a step. So you push, a healthy person will push and then will pull with the hip. And that, the total of the two gives you your propulsive force, approximately. So you push 2/3 and you pull about 1/3. So ankle plantar flexors push and hip flexors pull. Now, I'm going to show you two things. This is how we measure it. What you have here is a movement, the gait cycle along this axis, and these are the different measures. I just want you to look at two things. This is the power that we produce during a walking cycle. The red represents normal at similar low speeds. And here you have two patients, one who walks relatively fast in green, one who walks slow in yellow, and this is the pull phase, the H3. You see how it's much lower in the patients. And this is the push-off, where you have the normal curve in red, the green, which is a good push-off in one of the patients, and almost nothing in the patient walking very slowly. So we're going to concentrate on these two things in the therapy. This is the design. It's a multiple, it's a repeated design in a single case. We call it an ABA design. And so you take two measures before you start training to get a baseline. Then you do your training, then you measure again, and then you have a follow-up. So we're talking about 0, 3, 6, and 9 weeks. So this time I'm going to tell you about a therapy that takes 9 hours, individual therapy. And this is just to convince you that these are good walkers. 144 centimeters per second, 122, 125, and the fourth a little bit lower. I will generally speak of these three. So these are relatively well-rehabilitated patients. This is the training, individual sessions, 3 times a week for 3 weeks. This is typically what was done during these sessions. Walk 400 meters on even ground, go up and down stairs, ascend and descend slopes, strengthening exercise by stepping up and down on blocks forward and sideways, sit to stand, chair of and block height to maximize the use of the affected leg muscles, and specific exercises for the plantar flexor muscles. Heel lifts, not just one, not just two, 20. Heel lifts while standing on the affected leg, 20 times. Heel lifts by affected leg while the affected hip is extended. And I can go on. It's much more intense than anything we had previously done. Obstacle walking, 6 obstacles in 6 meters, minimum of 50 repetitions. Placement of obstacles to encourage long steps. Flexion of hip and knee during the swing phase while they go over these obstacles. And of course, treadmill walking, 5 to 8 minutes above 3.5 kilometers per hour. Kilometers per hour. All right, what are the results? After 9 hours of therapy, in the 3 patients who walked well, an average of 15% change in the preferred gait speed. Stair test, higher, closer, somewhere between 20 and 25 on average. Now, what's the stair test? The patients have to sit in a chair, 3 meters from chair to stairs, go up 14 stairs, turn around, come down 14 stairs, 3 meters, sit down again, time it. Okay, so we're looking at a timing test, and what you see here is there's more change in this. There's more change in an activity that required more endurance. And the 6-minute walk test, which measures this functional capacity and endurance, there's an even greater change. And we were very surprised in this. And what it's telling us is that these patients were really impaired in terms of functional capacity and what we call clinical endurance. And just to show you that what the purpose was to improve pull-off here at the hip, and you see here it did happen. There was an improvement. And if you look at push-off here, it happened for the 3 patients. And so the target of the therapy did produce measurable change in those 2 factors. So then we went further with this and we tried to understand why the patients had such an impairment in their functional capacity. And so what you have here is a series of patients with chronic stroke in red compared with a series of healthy persons. And what we did was we put the results of walking for 6 minutes along this axis in meters and the walking speed along here. And what you see is the healthy subjects walk more than 1.5, which is 150 centimeters per second. And they all have a distance of somewhere around 600 meters or more. All the stroke patients are lower, even though some walk equally quickly when measured over 10 meters. So we took it a step further and added regression equations to the questionnaire. And so what you see here are the healthy subjects, and this was the actual distance walked. This was the distance that you could predict if you measured walking speed. So you measured walking speed and then calculated the distance they should walk in 6 minutes. And then this here was the distance that you could predict from a regression equation. So what you see here is there's a bit of a difference here from the 10-meter calculation, but there's not that much difference. And when you look at stroke, you see it's quite different, and it shows that the actual distance walk cannot be really well estimated by calculating from 10 meters, the gait speed over 10 meters. And if you take the regression equation, you see quite a difference. And so what this is telling us is that the usual way of measuring recovery when you only take gait speed in the clinic is not sufficient. And it's not measuring functional capacity over time, and you cannot calculate it. You overestimate if you do that. Therefore, you must have a measure of functional capacity or endurance. Now, I just wanted to mention that there are other recent studies have emphasized, the title of their publication was Effects of Muscle Strengthening and Physical Conditioning Training on Temporal, Kinematic, and Kinetic Variables During Gait and Stroke Survivors. This is Sandy Olney's group at Queen's University. The first name here is a graduate student. And two studies out of UBC, a community-based group exercise program for persons with chronic stroke, submitted by Dr. Janice Eng here at the university. And a second study, a randomized controlled trial of water-based exercise for cardiovascular fitness in individuals with chronic stroke. And one of Dr. Eng's graduate students is first author. So there's more and more interest in this kind of approach. Now, what are the implications? First of all, these studies are pointing to the need for accessible exercise programs that emphasize functional capacity for persons with chronic stroke in order to enhance and to maintain gains. These can be short-term programs. I've shown you programs 9 to 12 hours long, and they could last 3 to 4 weeks. And I've shown you that they can be beneficial in some persons. And if we continue to do further trials, we probably will see that it does help a great many people. I've also shown you that it's very necessary to measure functional walking capacity. It's not enough to measure gait speed. And then we have to think of healthcare resource utilization. We should think of home care. We should think of planning these, and if you'll excuse the term, tune-ups for our persons with stroke to give them a chance to maintain their gains instead of forgetting them once they leave the rehabilitation. So I'd like to acknowledge Catherine Dean's contribution and the contribution of Dr. Francine Malouin and our technical assistance group. So now I'll take you to another area. What we know from the literature and from experience and from reading the results of various trials and also from reading the literature on motor learning, is that time spent practicing by persons with strokes is very low compared to high-performance athletes or musicians. Just think, many of you have children, just think of the hours they have to spend to learn how to play the piano or the violin. Just think of the Olympic athletes and the thousands of hours they spend practicing. And then think of our persons with stroke. We see them an hour a day, 5 days a week, and they're lucky if we see them for 2 months in a rehabilitation unit. There are some studies that have examined the use of time in rehabilitation units, and it's actually shocking what the patients do when they're not in therapy. They don't try to help themselves. Usually they watch TV or they smoke, they socialize, they play cards. They could be helping themselves if we told them how. We haven't been telling them how. There is a dramatic need for patient empowerment. The patients have to tell us what they want, and we have to help them to achieve those goals. And if they are practicing what they want to practice, then they'll help us. We have to provide for safe practice that is not necessarily physically tiring, because after a stroke, one is often tired. So we have to think of a way of providing for practice without it being excessively tiring. And also, we have not really provided practice that is varied, environmentally contextual, and motivational. We walk the patients in the rehab unit. Rarely do we take them outside. And then when you think of where I live, in the winter we have snow and ice, and we don't practice them on snow and ice. We rarely practice them on inclines or stairs. So this led us to two types of studies. One is a group of studies investigating the potential of mental practice to promote recovery after stroke. And I've done this work with Francine Malouin, who is my colleague at Laval University, Dr. Julien Doyen, who is a neuropsychologist and a specialist in imaging. He's at the University of Montreal. Martin Lafleur and Philip Jackson, two of our PhD students who have now finished in neuropsychology. And Dr. Joanne Desrosiers from the University of Sherbrooke, and Sylvie Belleville, who's a neuropsychologist from the University of Montreal. I'll just briefly present some preliminary data on different types of studies. First, for definition, what am I talking about? Motor imagery, it's the imagining of movements without their execution. And there are two components. You have to imagine yourself doing the movement. You have to see yourself, and you have to feel yourself doing the movement. So kinesthetic means that you feel yourself doing the movement. And visual means that you see yourself doing the movement. And how do you translate that into practice? We call it mental practice, and it's the idea that you use this imagery, you repeat the movement in your mind. For example, here I'm showing you a slap shot. I could have shown you a golfer. This is well known in the field of athletics. Apparently Jack Nicklaus does this all the time. I try, but it helps sometimes. So I'm going to show you the results of one study done by Martin Lafleur in his doctorate. So we're looking at how motor learning produces parallel, dynamic, functional changes during the execution and imagination of sequential foot movements. Why sequential foot movements? Well, we work with neuropsychologists, and we had to define a task, imagine a task that could be done under imaging conditions. And so the literature is very helpful on how you measure how we learn sequential tasks. But the literature, by and large, is concerned with upper limb movements. And so we didn't have anything that we could use for lower limb movements and for locomotion. And so we worked on this task. We invented this task. And what it is, as I will show you, it's movements of the foot to an auditory tone. And there are six components to this movement. So if the tone goes up, you put your foot up. If the tone goes down, your foot goes down. So it's beep, beep, bop, bop, beep, bop, beep. I think I had six there. Okay, and you have to learn this. And once you've learned it, you can measure it because you have reaction times. So you have a behavioral measure. And also, you can measure the changes in cerebral blood flow by using PET scans. So here were the objectives: to compare changes in cerebral activity as measured by PET scans between the early and more advanced learning phases of a physically practiced sequential foot movement, and to compare the changes produced by physical practice with those produced by imagining the same sequence. Now, this is the task I've told you about. And these here are the physical measures. And this is the serial reaction time. This is the control measured shortly after the person had learned the task. How do you define they've learned the task? You ask them to repeat it a few times. And if they do it correctly, then you say they've learned the task. And so, you take a control measure here. This is a random sequence. This is the sequence that they've learned. You do a CAT scan. Physical practice. These are sets of practice, blocks of practice. Take about 45 minutes to an hour. Then you do another scan, and then you measure again. And so you can see that the time goes down in terms of reaction time. So that means that there's been learning that you can measure behaviorally. Now let me show you what it does to the CAT scan. So what you have here is the measurement taken just after the subjects, and these are normal subjects, have learned the sequence. And you see these parts of the brain activated. This is a change in cerebral blood flow produced by doing the task. And this is when you do it physically. And then when you ask the subject to think about it, to imagine it, the same parts of the brain light up. And then over here is the advanced. And what you see is there's less activation after the learning is later. It's more advanced. And here you see the same when the patient imagines that movement. And this is a summary. Similar brain areas are activated during physical or mental rehearsal of movement sequences of the left foot. Note that similar changes at a more advanced stage of learning, less brain areas are activated after learning, and the activation is more localized. And that's what you would expect to find. Now, here are some other aspects to this mental imagery and mental practice. It turns out that there's a relationship between the time that you take to perform a movement physically and the time that you take to think about it, to imagine it. And this is well known from the literature. Therefore, we applied it to patients with stroke. The idea is to measure the number of repetitions a subject is able to perform mentally over variable periods of time duration. And these are results from Francine Malouin's study, where she asked the patients to imagine taking blocks from one box and placing them into another. And so we have a group of healthy subjects. We have a group of persons with stroke. And what happens is you tell the patient to imagine that they are transferring the blocks, but you don't tell them when you're going to tell them to stop. So they're going, and they tell you every time they've done it once. So one, two, three, and then you tell them to stop. And so what's supposed to happen is that you transform more blocks in 35 seconds than in 15 seconds. And it turns out that persons with stroke show a similar relationship. Now, this is a result in one patient over time. It's a combined mental and physical practice, and it's a case study. A 39-year-old man with a left subcortical lesion. The task was the one I told you about, the foot sequence. And so these are the results. This is the first 10 here. The patient practices physically the sequence. And you see the improvement here. And then there's a plateau. Then, for the next week, physical practice and mental practice are practiced together. And so you see it goes down some more. And then there's a break here. And for 2 weeks, the person practices mental practice only. And you see that when it's measured again, it goes down still some more. And so you see that improvement with the addition of mental practice and further improvement with mental practice alone. So there seems to be some potential here, but this is only a case study. We have to go further with it. And finally, I'll show you what we call a more ecological task. And again, the leader in this work is Francine Malouin. And this time, we are looking at the task of sit to stand and stand to sit. And the patients here, they stand on force plates. There's a force plate under the seat, and we can measure these things. And what we're interested in is how much weight they put on the paralyzed side, on the affected side. And so what happens in normal persons is that there's a line here that's difficult to see, but that's in normal persons. And they just about equally share the weight as they get up, the vertical force. So this is in standing up, this is in sitting down. Now this is a patient who has been trained by looking at the video, the curves that you see here, and before the measurement, the patient was trained to modify the way he rose by looking at the feedback and by telling himself verbally what he had to do to change the behavior. And then the video was taken away, and then this was measured to see if there was a change here. And then there was a session of practice where physical practice was combined with mental practice. And so what you see then is that this red curve here is before training. The yellow curve is immediately after, and the blue curve is 24 hours later. And the same thing you can see here for sitting down. And so this is really a dramatic change over a short time of practicing when you combine physical practice and mental practice. So, just to tell you about ongoing studies, we're about to start an endurance training in persons with acute stroke, because everything that I've shown you to date in terms of endurance training has been with chronic stroke. And so we will do a first project in collaboration with the cardiologist, Dr. Robitaille, and Dr. Sharon Wood Dauphiny and Francine Malouin and Claude Côté from Laval, and Ms. Louise Miranda, who is in charge of the stroke unit. This project has recently been funded by the Quebec Rehabilitation Research Network. We will also continue to develop and to evaluate the potential of virtual reality to increase practice and promote recovery after stroke. Now, these projects on virtual reality will be done with researchers at the CREER. The CREER is another interdisciplinary research center in Montreal, and we share a Canadian Foundation for Innovation grant with these researchers. And in that grant, we promised to develop virtual reality because they bought the equipment for us to do it. So now we're in the process of writing the grants to get the money to make the machines work. And I'm doing this with Dr. Joyce Fung and her colleagues at McGill University, Drs. Malouin, McFadden, and Edwards, as well as Lorando from Laval University. And what's different from our usual contingent of researchers is that we're working very much more with engineers, and there's one man here, Dr. Edwards, is a cognitive, is an expert in cognitive geomatics. And if you don't know what that is, I didn't until about a month ago. And that's, cognitive geomatics is the interaction of the person with the space around him. And so you can see how this relates to virtual reality. As I've told you, the infrastructure is funded by the Canadian Foundation for Innovation. And this is our very first virtual reality scenario. I had this picture taken about a month ago. And what happens here is that as the person walks on the treadmill, the person powers the treadmill. The treadmill is connected by software to the virtual reality. And in this case, what you see is a corridor in our rehabilitation institute, and our engineers have programmed this. And so as the person makes the treadmill move, he walks into this virtual reality and decides the speed at which he does it. Now, this is our very first. We're planning to develop scenarios that will allow for optimal practice. And by optimal practice, I mean strategies to avoid obstacles. I mean walking up inclines, walking on slippery surfaces, this kind of thing. And also practice that should be safe because there's a harness system so that the patient will not fall. And also, we want to develop some scenarios to see if we can work with that to diagnose some walking disorders that are related to the use of the eyes such and other sensory conflicts. Before I end, I would be remiss if I didn't tell you about all the granting agencies that have funded this work, and I have listed them here, particularly the National Health Research and Development Program, the FRSQ, Canadian Foundation for Innovation, the Canadian Stroke Network of Excellence, a research fund at Laval University that funded Kathy Dean, the Rehabilitation Network of Quebec, and the Heart and Stroke Foundation of Canada. And so in ending, I bring you greetings from Quebec City. I invite you to come and visit, and I thank you for being such a marvelous audience. Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Richards has kindly consented to answer questions. Yes.
Okay. The question is about food consumption. How does the food you eat affect you after stroke? And I have to admit that I'm not a nutritionist, and I don't know very much about this. But I would imagine that it's very important to eat the usual Canada Health Rules type of food. But perhaps Dr. Weber can help me out here. Is there a nutritionist in the audience? I'm sorry, sir, but I'm not very good at this. This lady here, perhaps?
Yeah. My daughter.
There was another question here.
Yes. In Vancouver, at St. Paul's Hospital, there's what is known as the Healthy Heart Program. It's a three-month program, and I happen to be a graduate. But I have never had a stroke. I do have a heart problem. And I'm wondering if the various data that you've accumulated applies to people who have not had stroke. Some of them, what I believe is known as ischemia.
Yes, the question is, this gentleman is a graduate of the heart program at one of the hospitals. And he's asking me if I have any data related to people who do not have stroke. Did I interpret you correctly? I don't have any data per se, but I have what everybody's talking about and what is on the web if you go to a healthy heart, if you go to the websites. And what they're saying to us is that to be healthy, you have to be active and you have to bring your heart rate up to a certain amount every day, like you've learned to do in your program. And I can refer you to the website of Health Canada, which describes how much exercise you should be doing every day and how much you need to do a week. And it's very nicely described, and if you write to them, they send you the booklet for free. So it's really all detailed there. And I would imagine it fits right into what you've been doing. Beg your pardon?
You said you could refer us.
Yes. Do you know it exactly? It's probably www.healthcanada.ca, and then it's .ca, and then go into healthy living. Oh, somebody says you've got to put a .gov in there.
We're guessing.
We're guessing, but it's probably www.healthcanada.ca. I think .ca would probably get you there. And then once you get into the site, go into healthy living. And there's one especially for elderly people. Healthy living for seniors or something like that. Okay, have you looked it up?
Not specifically, only the website name.
Yeah, but the healthy living part?
Yes, that's something I believe I've looked at.
Okay.
Yes.
In your first example, you get some nice evidence that getting people active very early after the stroke seems to be beneficial, but in the later studies, I guess you weren't able to get patients that early.
Yes, I do. And the evidence is very much in that direction. The animal evidence is in that direction, and the evidence that we have with persons is in that direction. It's when we say early, it means after they're medically stable. And it looks like as soon as they're stable, we should be getting them up and at it. And for example, if you can lose the concept of movement, and if you try to at least maintain the neural substrates in order, you can sort of hope that you potentialize recovery. And that's why perhaps down the line we might be able to use some of this mental practice. But we have to check it out first. And another idea for that was that if you think of people in casts, how difficult it is to move once they get out of them, or persons that are not allowed to move, we could use this to keep the neural substrates going. And so that once you're ready to move, at least the wiring is still there. Because it's shown that if you don't use your brain, it changes. And there's very nice evidence that shows that activity changes the brain. And so more and more now we know that physical activity that is well organized and well planned can help maintain the parts of the brain that are usually involved. It can also take over other parts of the brain. And so without going into all kinds of details, we call this brain plasticity. And we've only known about it for about less than 10 years. And it started out with animal studies with monkeys who were asked to pull olives out of a jar. Very nice studies done in Kansas City by somebody called Nudo. And he showed that the number of times the monkey does this and the difficulty of the task relates to how the brain changes. So if you keep doing the same thing, even monkeys get bored. and it doesn't change the brain. So you have to change the type of practice in order to activate and to keep activating the neurons. And now we're starting to see this with human studies, and the first study with functional MRI that came out last year at Neuroscience in San Diego, and a researcher from the University of Southern California, Catherine Sullivan, was able to show that when you practice treadmill walking in persons after stroke, that you can show changes in the brain. And so now many researchers are looking into this. So this imagery has been a boon for rehabilitation, because for years, people used to say, it's all very well, sure, you can help people walk better, you can help people, you know, do activities of daily living better, but you can't return them to normal. You can't change the brain. Well, it turns out that that's wrong. You can change the brain. And so from rehabilitation being something that, you know, was sort of last on the totem pole of medicine, now everybody wants to do it. You go to these conferences and neuropsychologists do rehabilitation and all kinds. I was going to say anatomists do rehabilitation, but I don't have one right off the bat. So, but all kinds of people are doing it.
Yes, up here.
Could you say a little more about the use of virtual
reality? Yeah. Yes, the lady would like to know if I could talk a bit more about mental imagery and about virtual reality. Well, as you saw, this is brand new. Now, the mental imagery we've been working on since about 1996 with a team of neuropsychologists. And, you know, we're in Quebec City, and we have to drive to Montreal to do the scans because we don't have the setup in Quebec City. And so it's been really difficult recruiting the patients when you're not physically there with the patients. And so that's a downside of it. But in terms of what it's telling us, the results are very positive. We've done another study where we had the patients simulate walking tasks. For example, initiating walking, and walking around obstacles. And we showed them videos before we did the PET scans. And then we were able to show that when they do these different tasks, they activate the different parts of the brain that you'd expect them to activate if they were actually walking. And so we know that it's something that fits in. So that was the first study that we did, sort of giving us the leeway to go on. The next study I showed you, those were results from the second study. And now we've gone into another study where we have patients with stroke. And it's not as easy as with patients with stroke because they all have different lesions. And so we have some data on patients with lesions of the striatum, sort of subcortical lesions. And we're finding that they have a lot of difficulty learning. So we now have to control that with patients with other kinds of lesions. And so we're in that phase. And what we're doing at the same time is we're trying to figure out how can you tell that a person will be able to imagine? Because if you can't imagine, there's no purpose in doing this. And then some literature shows that certain lesions, such as lesions of the parietal lobe, prevent you from imagining. Some persons can't imagine. And so we have to have these clinical tests in order to determine if the patient is able to imagine. That's why I showed you these timing tests. That's one of the avenues. But there are other avenues as well, such as questionnaires, specific questionnaires, where you ask the patients to perform a task, and then to describe in their own words how they felt it and how they saw it and to score that. And from that, you can determine whether they can imagine or not. So that's another avenue. And then the third one, I showed you a little bit about these, what I call ecological tasks. But that was, again, the first time where we were able to combine these two. And I mean, this is sort of a one-shot training, and you see these amazing changes. What we're working on also is how many times do you have to mentally practice in relation to physical practice? Because what you should not go away with is that you do mental practice alone. Mental practice is seen as an adjunct, something to help potentialize physical practice. So the data I've shown you, what it was meant to show is that if you add it on, it will help you. But we're not saying to do it alone. We'd only say to do it alone if you couldn't move. Okay? And so I'll just finish with this lady. The last thing we've done is we've taken the results from this last study, sit to stand, and we've looked at working memory. Because there's a relationship between the types of memory you have and how you are capable of imagining and capable of retaining these things. And we're finding very interesting things there. And lastly, we've asked for money from CIHR, which is the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, to do a randomized controlled trial to evaluate whether mental practice can potentialize recovery. We don't have the money yet, we just sent it in. So that's where we are. Does that answer your question? Okay, sir? Yes, the question, it's a good one, and I'm trying to find the answer. The question is, if you're physically active before you have the stroke, is your recovery different than somebody who wasn't physically active?
Or moderately active.
Yeah, it's a terrific question. I don't have a direct or a data-related answer. But my personal feeling is that those that are used to exercise react best afterwards because they understand the concept of exercise, and they understand the concept of movement and of getting their heart rate up. And this idea of getting your heart rate up to a certain extent, you of course have to work with cardiologists to ensure that there's no problem with doing these exercises. I'm not saying that you should go out and do it without having your doctor give you the okay. But what we've discovered is that we have neglected this aspect. And it turns out that when you're not physically fit, whether you're a person who does not have a stroke or a person that has a stroke, you're not potentializing your ability. And I think you're probably onto something important, but I have no measurement to give you. Yes, sir. Yep, it does, and there's a very big clinical trial currently being funded by NIH in the States, being run in 6 centers in the States to answer this question. And if I'll repeat what the gentleman said, for the upper extremity, there's a treatment out there where they tie up the good arm and force you to use the bad arm. It's called constraint-induced therapy. And there are several reports in the literature with a few patients that shows that the recovery is better in the arm than it was before. But there's a big problem because of lack of controls. And so the answer is not out there yet. But the main problem is that they take these patients for 2 weeks usually, sometimes 3, and they tie up the good arm for 5 or 6 hours a day. And they work the other arm for those 5 or 6 hours. Now, if you took any therapy and you worked the arm the same amount of time, you know, what would happen? So that's the question we have to answer. And I'm not convinced you have to tie the good arm in order to work the other arm. Because it's really quite dramatic if you imagine somebody with a very impaired arm trying to have a drink of water. The other thing is, in order to be acceptable for this kind of therapy, they require you to be able to move your wrist about this much. And very few patients can do that. And so it's not a therapy that everybody can use. Because if you can't do that, you can't participate in the tasks. Therefore, you can't find recovery. I thought you were going to ask me what would happen if you tie up one leg. And it turns out that the same proponent of this in the States, there's a group at the University of Alabama with a psychologist called Everett Taube. That's a Swedish. Edward Taube. The other one is a Swedish guitarist. Thank you. His guess. What's his name?
Edward
Taube, and not Taube. And he claims that having somebody walk on a treadmill and in other activities 5 to 6 hours a day also is constraint-induced type of therapy. Because you can't really tie up one leg because you've got to maintain your weight on it. But again, the same question is it because of this mass practice or is it because of this new type of therapy? And our evidence shows, and the evidence of many others shows, that it's practice related. And that study I showed you about our therapists in Quebec City, it shows that it's really the amount of hours that you practice, and it's not on what you practice it. And so it's a big, big question out there right now in rehabilitation, this constraint-induced, and I hope the trial will soon be out. It's very well planned and with excellent researchers in charge, Dr. Stephen Wolf from Atlanta and Carol Lee Weinstein from the University of Southern California. It has been used for years in stroke. Beg your pardon. The question is about the use of functional electrical stimulation, and the gentleman related it to the work done with Christopher Reeve, and he asked if it has been done with stroke. Am I correct? And the answer is yes, it has been. Probably not to the same extent, and usually for selected muscles. And what happens is it works, but you always have to have the machine. As soon as you take it away, it goes back because the patient doesn't learn with the machine. So as long as you have the stimulator on, you may lift your foot better. And for a while after, you'll keep lifting your foot better and then you won't anymore. So it becomes a little bit of a crutch so far. But there have been some successes, and especially in patients where there's a particular impairment that inhibits what they need to do. For example, if it's only lifting the foot, but if it's a massive problem, then it doesn't work so well so far.
I have two questions. And the first one, at the beginning of the lecture, you distinguish two kinds of stroke. One is ischemic, the other one is hemorrhagic stroke. In your study, do you find any differences in response?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating questions. Okay, the first one is easy for me to answer. The question is whether we see a difference in recovery with ischemic stroke as opposed to hemorrhagic. And I told you that about 80% are ischemic. In our studies, as much as possible, we try to only take ischemic stroke because hemorrhagic strokes are harder to sort of predict what will happen. And often they're younger, sometimes after an aneurysm or something like that. So we try to avoid them, but sometimes there are a few in the studies. And because there are only a few, I don't really have an answer for you. Most of the studies in rehabilitation are for ischemic stroke. Now the second question was about imagery. And the gentleman said that imagery is used for all kinds of things, such as alleviating pain, used in for cancer patients to help recovery. And his question was very intriguing. He asked whether perhaps we could use imagery to open up blocked blood vessels. And I'm trying to find an answer to this. And my free association takes me to migraine headaches related to constriction of the blood vessels. And I've heard that possibly imagery can help that. And so I have to speculate. I have no evidence. But I would not, having seen what happens, I would not, I would have to check to see if it was possible before saying it wasn't.
I think given the burden we put on Dr. Richards this week, I'm going to limit us to two more questions. And perhaps up at the back here.
You've been talking about recovery from catastrophic neurological damage. Do you think that your results apply to progressive neurological problems like MS or Parkinson's?
All right. I gave a lecture last week on MS. And the people who have MS are learning more and more that they have to be in good physical shape. And what we are now learning about stroke, I found evidence in the literature, at least 4 or 5 studies, that applies to people with MS. Water-based conditioning programs, when the water is not too hot. Bicycle, ergonomic type of exercises for the legs and the arms. And it's very positive. I can't relate to the other parts, but persons with MS can also learn to change their walking pattern and what have you. But what I know for sure is that the fatigue factor in MS is no longer perceived as limiting in terms of physical conditioning. And that goes back to literature from 1990. You okay with that? Do I need to repeat the question? Did you hear it?
Please.
Okay. This gentleman came to my lecture on Tuesday night, and that was devoted to the applications of mental practice. And he has been using it on one of his patients since. Now, he's concerned because he has a patient with stroke who, when he attempts to imagine the movements on his affected leg, which is the right leg, moves the left leg, but also moves the affected leg, and possibly in a pattern that this gentleman would like to avoid. Have I got it right? Okay. Now, the question is, should he continue, or should he stop him because maybe the pattern's not right? I may shock you with my answer. My feeling is, if anything moves, use it. And the problem with physical therapy in the past is that we have even put patients into what we called inhibiting postures to prevent movement. And then for years, we wouldn't let them move. We wouldn't let them walk if they couldn't stand properly. And then we wouldn't let them move into the walking pattern if it wasn't perfect. Consequently, we sometimes did not allow patients to walk for 3 or 4 weeks after stroke. And that's not what we think today at all. And so task-oriented means It's a goal-oriented movement, and it doesn't matter if it's not perfect, as long as you move it. And the patient doesn't care if it's not perfect, as long as he can get there. And so it's quite a shift, a paradigm shift, from the way we were thinking as late as 1985. And so my feeling is,